At 11, Sarika Mehta hosts Between the Covers. Her guest is Julia Cook, author of The Other Side of Paradise, Life in the New Cuba. And at 11:30, The Film Show welcomes Dario Van Vrie, founder of the Netherlands Click Animation Festival, which is currently on a tour of the West Coast. Also joining us are young filmmakers from Free Arts Northwest, as well as Hannah Piper Burns and Benjamin Pop of the Experimental Film Festival. That's all coming up this morning, but stick around. Up next, Teresa Mitchell hosts Press Watch, news you're not supposed to know. Stick around, that's next on KBOO.
Sun Ra. Hailed as one of the great big band leaders, pianists, and surrealists of jazz in the New York Times. Composer, keyboardist, bandleader, philosopher, poet, and self-proclaimed extraterrestrial. Sun Ra arrived on the Earth 100 years ago on May 22, 1914. This Thursday, May 22, 2014, KBOO will dedicate the airwaves to 12 hours of the music, life, and philosophy of one of the 20th century's greatest avant-garde artists, Sun Ra. Beginning at 7 p.m., continuing all night long until 7 a.m. with a special in-studio performance of the Sonic Innovators Orchestra, featuring students of Thera Memories and conducted by David Ornette Cherry at 9 p.m. That's this Thursday, beginning at 7 p.m., a 12-hour tribute to the phenomenon known as Sun Ra, here on KBOO Portland.
How do you stop it?
May 31st at the Star Theater. Join Green Empowerment and 300 sustainability movers and shakers for the second annual Passport to Empowerment benefit party to raise money for renewable energy and water projects in remote villages. DJ Anjali, Love Bomb Go-Go, and their 17-piece marching band, Filipino tinikling stick dancers, an airless performance, and food and cocktails from Nicaragua, Philippines, and Malaysia. Tickets are available at greenempowerment.org/passport. Passport to Empowerment is May 31st at the Star Theater. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Yellow Pages, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit pdxgyp.com.
This is Press Watch, a weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program here on your people-supported free radio station, KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Join me for a brief peek behind the video veil of Monopoly media manipulation and an examination of the news you are not supposed to know. Radcast's latest data shows Portland radioactivity at 32 counts per minute, down from 38, so have a nice day already. And this week's show is dedicated to Cecily McMillan, who elbow-punched a cop. Not that she knew it was a cop, as he brutally groped and bruised her breast during an Occupy protest. She's going to do 90 days in Rikers to punish her for defending herself against Mr. Grabby and to prevent you from thinking that you have any rights at all, especially under the First Amendment to the Constitution, which states, or shall I say stated, that the right of the people peacefully to assemble should not be legislated against was sacred. Ha! Always put your hips into your punches when you're fighting off groping cops, girls. This week, an unknown and unfunded Occupy protester and open socialist took 19% of the votes away from a well-funded incumbent in the Portland City Council election. He was proposing the imposition of a living wage, like the $15 per hour minimum, now being implemented by popular demand in Seattle. And this from Al Jazeera America. Coming on the heels of the worldwide protest of low wages at fast food outlets, quoting, more than 100 McDonald's workers were arrested after staging a sit-in and blocking the entrance to the company's headquarters in Oak Brook, Illinois, a day before the McDonald's annual shareholders meeting, according to labor activists. The move comes days after unions worldwide joined forces to ask for better pay and working conditions at the fast food chain. Kendall Fells, leader of Fast Food Forward, said the action would force executives to look their employees in the eye while workers could tell them in their faces that they're sick and tired of living in poverty. This time, Fells said the workers were prepared to stay put until they are heard, chanting, "Hey, McDonald's, you can't hide. We can see your greedy side." And, "No Big Macs, no fries, make our wages supersized." I like that last one. The workers marched on to the McDonald's campus, where police officers arrested 101 workers who ignored their order to disperse, according to a statement from Fast Food Forward. And Al Jazeera writes, McDonald's employee Adriana Alvarez, 21, said she joined Wednesday's action to show that it's really hard to live off her wages as a single mother. She said, "We're tired of it. We're at a tipping point. We're done." Studies show that more than two-thirds of low-income workers are women. There's more on that article at Al Jazeera America. Memories. I remember, gosh, almost three decades ago, helping coordinate and execute a protest against McDonald's. We were done with Reaganism. We were pretty sure that some sort of revolution was coming down the line. You never know. Well, today I want to talk about exponential climate disasters. I've often talked about an acceleration in the acceleration on the climate news. And I just have more information on that. SFist, SanFranciscoist.com, writes, climate scientists are all pretty well on board with the prediction that this coming winter is going to be a severe El Nino season. And for those who did not live in Northern California during the winter of 97-98, that means, he writes, we're in for some serious nonstop rain and period of dreariness that will be the opposite of this shiny, shiny summer we just had. But now at least one scientist is linking El Nino to spikes in overall average temperatures around the globe and suggesting that 2015 is going to be a doozy of high temperature sweating, devastation like we've never seen. As discussed yesterday on the New York Times Upshot blog, climate change skeptics have been quick to point out that cooling trends have prevailed over the last decade, defying models that suggested overall warming year over year. But cycles of El Nino and La Nina, in which the Pacific Ocean surface temperatures alternately warm and cool, may be the best explanation for the recent dips, since La Nina seasons have prevailed since 1998 and El Ninos have been mild to moderate. A severe El Nino is likely not only to mean a wet winter for the West and the South, but it could cause severe droughts in Australia and bring high temperatures roaring back across the globe next year, and it could affect weather for years to come. But, he writes, El Nino has the potential to do more than offer a one-time jolt to climate activists. It could unleash a new wave of warming that could shape the debate for a decade or longer. In this chain of events, a strong El Nino causes a shift in a longer cycle known as the Pacific Decadal Oscillation, which favors more frequent and intense El Ninos during its warm or positive phase. The oscillation has been negative or cool since the historic El Nino at 1998. More at sfist.com. It's 9:08. You're listening to Press Watch, news you're not supposed to know, on KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. NOAA.gov says the combined average temperature over global land and ocean surfaces for April 2014 tied with 2010 is the highest on record for the month at 0.77 centigrade or 1.39 Fahrenheit above the 20th century average of 56 degrees Fahrenheit. The global land surface temperature was above the 20th century average of 8.1 centigrade or 46 Fahrenheit, marking the third warmest April on record. For the ocean, the April global sea surface temperature was half a centigrade above the 20th century average of 16 centigrade or 60 degrees Fahrenheit, also the third highest for April on record. The combined global land and ocean average temperatures for the January-April period year-to-date was 0.64 centigrade, that's 1.15 degrees Fahrenheit above the 20th century average of 54.8 degrees Fahrenheit, the sixth warmest such period on record. So that's a little technical, a lot of numbers, but it's warmer. University of California, Irvine writes that the Greenland melt is even faster than we knew a couple of weeks ago, and there's more water involved. There are long, deep valleys connecting the ice cap to the ocean, apparently. They write, Greenland's icy reaches are far more vulnerable to warm ocean waters from climate change than had been thought, according to new research by UC Irvine and NASA glaciologists. The work, published May 18th in Nature Geoscience, shows previously uncharted deep valleys stretching for dozens of miles under the Greenland ice sheet. The bedrock canyons sit well below sea level, meaning that as subtropical Atlantic waters hit the fronts of hundreds of glaciers, those edges will erode much further than had been assumed and release far greater amounts of water. Ice melt from the subcontinent had already accelerated as warmer marine currents have migrated north, but older models predicted that once higher ground was reached in a few years, the ocean-induced melting would halt. Greenland's frozen mass would stop shrinking, and its effect on higher seawaters would be curtailed. They write, that turns out to be incorrect. The glaciers of Greenland are likely to retreat faster and further inland than anticipated, and for much longer, according to the very different topography we've discovered beneath the ice. And that's according to the lead author, Matthew Morgleham, a UCI associate project scientist. He says this has major implications because glacier melt will contribute much more to rising seas around the globe. Much more to that article. It's at redorbit.com. And an interesting thing, and as I was saying, piling on top of previous climate news about Greenland, which was all bad, and just to recap, what they're saying is that there are these enormous, well, I guess you could say ice fjords, valleys that go 65 miles inland, and there's a lot more ice there, therefore more water, and it provides an inroad for the ocean water to get in and to increase the melting. Melting of BC glaciers, by the way. British Columbia glaciers is increasing, as is worldwide glacial melting. British Columbia, for example, has increased its input and is now putting out 10% of the volume of the Mississippi River each year, flowing from the glaciers into the sea, and the glaciers are receding. ScienceBlogs.com writes that climate change impacts in the United States have been well assessed by the new National Climate Assessment. And Peter Gleick, writing for scienceblogs.com, has a several-point summary of the official climate assessment. And this is pretty conservative, just like the other assessments that you may have seen. This is pretty conservative, but when it brings it all together, it gives you some idea of what we're in for. And I want to just throw in my opinion that I think this year will be tumultuous in terms of climate news. Certainly it already has been if you're living in Serbia. The first point on that new national climate assessment is that global climate is changing and that this is apparent. Across the United States, in a wide range of observations, global warming of the past 50 years is primarily due to human activities, predominantly the burning of fossil fuels. Many independent lines of evidence confirm that human activities are affecting climate in unprecedented ways. And the most recent decade was the warmest on record. Because human-induced warming is superimposed on a naturally varying climate, rising temperatures are not evenly distributed across the country or over time. Secondly, some extreme weather and climate events have increased in recent decades. I'll read that again. Some extreme weather and climate events have increased in recent decades. And new and stronger evidence confirms that some of these increases are related to human activities. Now, departing from the text, that's an important one to remember because whenever there is a storm and people talk about global warming, of course, it is accurate to say that any one storm does not indicate global warming. However, the United States and its National Climate Assessment has done the numbers and says that yes, these events have increased. They write, changes, Peter Gleick writes in his summary, changes in extreme weather events are the primary way that most people experience climate change. Human-induced climate change has already increased the number and strength of these extreme events. Over the last 50 years, much of the United States has seen an increase in prolonged periods of excessively high temperatures, more heavy downpours, and in some regions, more severe droughts. Third, human-induced climate change is projected to continue, and it will significantly accelerate if global emissions of heat-trapping gases continue to increase. Heat-trapping gases already in the atmosphere have committed us to a hotter future with more climate-related impacts over the next few decades. The magnitude of climate change beyond the next few decades depends primarily on the amount of heat-trapping gases that human activities emit globally, now and in the future. Fourth, impacts related to climate change are already evident in many sectors. and are expected to become increasingly disruptive across the nation throughout this century and beyond. Climate change is already affecting societies and the natural world. Climate change interacts with other environmental and societal factors in ways that either moderate or intensify these impacts. The types and magnitudes of impact vary across the nation and through time. Children, the elderly, the sick, and the poor are especially vulnerable to climate change. There is mounting evidence that harm to the nation will increase substantially in the future unless global emissions of heat-trapping gases are greatly reduced. Fifth, climate change threatens human health and well-being in many ways, including through more extreme weather events and wildfire, decreased air quality, and diseases transmitted by insects, food, and water. Departing from the text, that's a zoonotic factor that I talked about. The appearance of diseases from stressed animals, including insects. Climate change, they write, is increasing the risks of heat stress, respiratory stress from poor air quality, and the spread of waterborne diseases. Extreme weather events often lead to fatalities and a variety of health impacts on vulnerable populations, including impacts on mental health, such as anxiety and post-traumatic stress disorder. Large-scale changes in the environment due to climate change and extreme weather events are increasing the risk of the emergence or reemergence of health threats that are currently uncommon in the United States, such as dengue fever. And once again, departing from that, dengue, also known as bone break fever, a very severe disease, a killer. Point number six, infrastructure is being damaged by sea level rise, heavy downpours, and extreme heat. Damages are projected to increase with continued climate change. Sea level rise, storm surge, and heavy downpours in combination with the pattern of continued development in coastal areas are increasing damage to U.S. infrastructure, including roads, buildings, and industrial facilities, and are also increasing risks to ports and coastal military installations, flooding along rivers, lakes, and cities following heavy downpours, prolonged rains, and rapid melting of snowpack is exceeding the limits of flood protection infrastructure designed for historical conditions. Extreme heat is damaging transportation infrastructure such as roads, rail lines, and airport runways. Once again, speaking for myself, locally we noticed this right away. Whenever it's really hot, those lines for the trams, the max lines, stretch out and the max stops. So very hot weather will predictably stop. We'll see if it's been repaired, but has predictably stopped interurban rail, light rail, here in Portland, in the Portland area. Seventh, water quality and water supply reliability are jeopardized by climate change in a variety of ways that affect ecosystems and livelihoods. Surface and groundwater supplies in some regions are already stressed by increasing demand for water as well as declining runoff and groundwater recharge. In some regions, particularly the southern part of the country and the Caribbean and Pacific Islands, climate change is increasing the likelihood of water shortages and competition for water among its many uses. Water quality is diminishing in many areas, particularly due to increasing sediment and contaminant concentrations after heavy downpours. You're listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Addressing that last issue, number seven, water quality and water supply reliability. We are seeing this in the Cascadian area. Whenever the snowpack is reduced, and we'll see more of that, I'm sure. Number eight. And by the way, of course, the increasing demand for water. The threat of water wars again. Number eight, climate disruptions to agriculture have been increasing and are projected to become more severe over the century. Some areas are already experiencing climate-related disruptions, particularly due to extreme weather events. While some regions in U.S. types of some U.S. regions and some types of agricultural production will be relatively resilient to climate change over the next 25 years or so, others will increasingly suffer from stresses due to extreme heat, drought, disease, and heavy downpours. From mid-century on, climate change is projected to have more negative impacts on crops and livestock across the country, a trend that could diminish the security of our food supply. And before I get to point number nine, I want to address that this is where the assessment reflects the fact that it is a rather carefully conservative or even reactive survey done by the United States. And all these years after the imposition of the Reagan regime, I reliably expect that there are corrupt influences on on what is published. And I beg to differ with this assessment in that it will not take 25 to 50 years for these severe impacts to be seen. And as I keep saying, there is acceleration in the acceleration. It was only a few years ago we weren't hearing about Antarctica slipping into the sea or Greenland slipping into the sea. That was all in the distant future. We weren't hearing about tundra fires. We weren't measuring soot particles changing the albedo of Greenland. So many factors, which all need to be brought together and apparently haven't been by this study. And so you get these figures of 25 to 50 years, which are enough to make you stop and do nothing. Well, that's not the world we're living in. The world we're living in, I think that probably you have noticed, as I have in the local area, that the size of raindrops is increasing, has increased over the last decade. That's very significant and has to do with the energy put into the clouds by increased heat locally. And that's just a little bitty thing, but we're seeing it now. And we're seeing all these other impacts now. All of these global impacts have an impact on each other. And this acceleration is accelerating. But going to point number 9, from the summary of the National Climate Assessment, climate change poses particular threats to indigenous people's health, well-being, and ways of life. They write, chronic stresses such as extreme poverty are being exacerbated by climate change impacts such as reduced access to traditional foods, decreased water quality, and increasing exposure to health and safety hazards in parts of Alaska, Louisiana, Pacific Islands, and other coastal locations. Climate change impacts through erosion and inundation are so severe that some communities are already relocating from historical homelands, and they don't say again, but it needs to say again, to which their traditions and cultural identities are tied, particularly in Alaska. The rapid pace of temperature rise, ice and snowmelt, and permafrost thaw are significantly affecting critical infrastructure and traditional livelihoods. Point number 10, ecosystems and the benefits that they provide to society are being affected by climate change. The capacity of ecosystems to buffer the impacts of extreme events like fires, floods, and severe storms is being overwhelmed. Climate change impacts, they write, on biodiversity are already being observed in the alteration of the timing of critical biological events such as the spring bud burst and substantial range shifts of many species. In the longer term, there is an increased risk of species extinction. These changes have social, cultural, and economic effects. Events such as droughts, floods, wildfires, and pest outbreaks associated with climate change. For example, bark beetles here in Cascadia are already disrupting ecosystems. These changes limit the capacity of ecosystems such as forests, barrier beaches, and wetlands to continue to play important roles in reducing the impacts of these extreme events on infrastructure, human communities, and other valued resources. Point number 11, ocean waters are becoming warmer and more acidic, broadly affecting ocean circulation, chemistry, ecosystems, and marine life. More acidic waters inhibit the formation of shells, skeletons, and coral reefs, and just have to step away from that right now and explain what that means. That can mean that you're going to have a harder time getting your favorite seafood. It means it's going to affect crab, shrimp, clams, oysters. They can't get started because more carbon in the atmosphere soaks into the ocean, basically, and creates carbolic acid. When they say it's more acidic, it actually has an acid in it, and it's too much. And the organisms that have evolved over millennia to over eons to absorb calcium in a certain way and at a certain pH level can't deal with it. Returning to what is written here, warmer waters harm coral reefs and alter the distribution, abundance, and productivity of many marine species. The rising temperature and changing chemistry of ocean water combined with other stresses, such as overfishing and coastal and marine pollution to alter marine-based food production and harm fishing communities. And the final point, 12th point, planning for adaptation to address and prepare for impacts and mitigation to reduce future climate change, for example, by cutting emissions, is becoming more widespread, but current implementation efforts are insufficient to avoid increasingly negative social, environmental, and economic consequences. So it's worth looking up the National Climate Assessment and the various summaries of that. You're listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland, And it's been an interesting week. There's been more information about NSA warrantless surveillance. Trevor Trim writes in The Guardian, two senators accused the Justice Department of lying about NSA warrantless surveillance to the U.S. Supreme Court last year, and those falsehoods all but ensured that mass spying on Americans would continue, but hardly anyone seems to care. Least of all those who lied and should have already come forward with the truth. Here's what happened, he writes, just before Edward Snowden became a household name, the ACLU argued before the Supreme Court that the FISA Amendments Act, one of the two main laws used by NSA to conduct mass surveillance, was unconstitutional. In a sharply divided opinion, the Supreme Court ruled 5-4 the case should be dismissed because the plaintiffs didn't have standing. In other words, that the ACLU couldn't prove with near certainty that their clients, which included journalists and human rights advocates, were targets of surveillance. So they couldn't challenge the law. As the New York Times noted this week, the court relied on two claims by the Justice Department to support their ruling. First, that the NSA would only get the content of Americans' communications without a warrant when they are targeting a foreigner abroad for surveillance, and second, that the Justice Department would notify criminal defendants who have been spied on under the FISA Amendments Act so that there exists some way to challenge the law in court. It turns out that neither of those statements were true. But it took Snowden's historic whistleblowing to prove it. One of the most explosive Snowden revelations exposed a then-secret technique known as about surveillance. As the New York Times first reported, the NSA is searching the contents of vast amounts of Americans' email and text communications into and out of the country, hunting for people who mention information about foreigners under surveillance. In other words, the NSA doesn't just target a contact overseas. It sweeps up everyone's international communications into a dragnet and searches them for keywords. The Snowden leaks also pushed the Justice Department to admit, contrary to what it told the court, that the government hadn't been notifying any defendants that they were being charged based on NSA surveillance, making it actually impossible for anyone to prove they had standing to challenge the FISA Amendments Act as unconstitutional. You've been listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland, and I would like to thank those of you who called in and those of you who have been supporting us at KBOO for years and years. And it's always satisfying. It's always a relief, I guess, to do a membership drive and see that people will call in and will support the station, and that we can move forward and that we can expand and we can, you know, just increase what we do and expand our mission. KBOO.fm, by the way, is how you pick it up online. And you can find Press Watch recordings, also known as, what's the word? Hey, Rock, what do you call a recording online? My brain is blanked out on it.
Oh my goodness. Now you're...
It's little numbers, little letters.
Numbers and letters.
MP3 files can be found. Podcasting, that's what I'm going to think of. Sorry, some days I just get kind of old and can't remember those words while I'm mousing around and clicking. And actually, you can get the podcast of Press Watch on KBOO.fm. And easy way to do it is to use the search bar and just put in Press Watch. And you can figure it out from there, I'm sure. KBOO Portland. And Jason Hertler has written just a couple of sentences from this. Tyranny's Toolkit is in counterpunch.org. I urge you to have a look at that. First couple of sentences. Citigroup concedes that we live in an age of plutonomy and the rest. During the mortgage meltdown, the free market apostles, too bad it's not the three market apostles, no, it's the free market apostles of Wall Street, beseech the state to intervene. No less than Princeton University declares the United States to be an oligarchy. And departing from that, I have to agree, we certainly are an oligarchy, at least. And I wouldn't say plutonomy, I'd say plutocracy. But, you know, we can fix their wagons. We can do it. We have to organize. I mean, heck, if the East Germans can kick out the Stasi, if the Romanians can kick out the secret police, if their blood flowed down the stairs, then we can do it too. So stay tuned to KBOO Portland for more information that'll help your part in the revolution. And I won't be back next week because I'm taking a week off. So I'll see you in 2 weeks. And all the ships at sea.
I'm Shahid Hamid, and I want to invite you to a very special 8-hour Memorial Day Soul and Rhythm and Blues experience right here on KBOO 90.7 FM from 12 o'clock noon to 8 p.m. with JJ leading us off from 12 noon to 2 o'clock, followed by Sequoyna Wright from 2 o'clock to 4 o'clock p.m., followed by yours truly, Shahid, from 4 o'clock to 6 o'clock p.m., and Reggae Bob taking us home from 6 o'clock to 8 o'clock p.m., from the old to the new, just for you, a very special Memorial Day Soul and Rhythm and Blues experience. Monday, May the 26th, 12 noon to 8 p.m., right here on KBOO Community Radio 90.7 FM, and online, www.kboo.fmradio.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the 14th Annual Village Building Convergence from Friday, May 23rd to Sunday, June 1st. The Village Building Convergence is a 10-day placemaking and urban permaculture festival that leaves a permanent, sustainable impact all across the city as an expression of what communities all across the city are ready to do in their own places. The VBC brings together a vast spectrum of related initiatives, such as community currency, grassroots democracy, ecological design, youth engagement, social justice in action, ecological stewardship, multimodal transportation, and so much more. This year's evening speakers and performers will be at the Sunnyside Methodist Church, 3520 Southeast Yamhill Street in Portland. A list of speakers and more information about the Village Building Convergence in general can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.